Have you ever had an idea for a physical product that you just knew had the potential to change the world? Maybe it was something you dreamt up in your garage or a solution to a problem you encountered in your daily life. Whatever it was, you knew it was a winner. If only you can turn that idea into something. You are not alone. Countless entrepreneurs and innovators have stood exactly where you stand, filled with passion and drive, but unsure of where to begin. That's where the Builder Circle comes in.
My name is Seda Evjaman, and I'm a mechanical engineer, hardware enthusiast, and hardware mentor. I've had the privilege of working with numerous hardware companies that are passionate about solving some of the biggest challenges in the world. And I will be your host as we explore the exciting and complex world of physical product development. I'm very excited to announce that this episode is sponsored by our friends at Onshape and Jigga. Starting with Onshape, Onshape is the only cloud-native product development platform. Onshape combines professional-grade CAD with built-in PDM and real-time collaboration tools all in one system with no downloads required. Through the Onshape Startup Program, eligible hardware startups receive free access to Onshape Professional for 1 year, including integrated CAM. Apply now at onshape.pro/thebuildercircle. You can also find this link in the show notes. Now we're on to our second sponsor, Jigga.
If you're sourcing custom parts, you know the choice. Instant quote platforms that hide suppliers behind a black box or local shops that run out of capacity when you need them. Jigga gives you both. Direct access to vetted manufacturers, reliable capacity, and competitive pricing. From prototype through production. You communicate directly with the people making your parts, you apply your expertise, you make the right calls. That's what professional hardware sourcing looks like. Visit jigga.io.
Welcome to the Builder Circle. Today, I have the honor and the privilege to have the one and only Peter Russo on the show. Peter, welcome. I'm so excited to have you.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Of course. For our listeners who don't know Peter, which I don't know how you couldn't because he is just everywhere. So Peter is an entrepreneur, advisor, and mentor. He's founded, built, and sold 5 companies and served acquisition teams for venture firms. I think one of the most impressive things about him is that he has created and licensed 15 brands and 2,000, he has seen 2,000 SKUs from concept to launch. So everything in between, he has seen that entire process into retail, which accounted for around $250 million in retail sales. And he has completely scoped and advised Mass MEP, Scale for Climate Tech, Forge, all of these incredible organizations, accelerators. And I get to talk to him about working with contract manufacturers, which is his absolute bread and butter. And I cannot wait. I feel like people are going to get such value out of this episode. Peter, thank you again.
You're building up a little too much. So I hope I can meet your expectations. It's 4 instead of 5 and sold 3. But I'm happy with that too.
Okay. I can certainly edit that out.
I was going to say you could leave it in. It's so playful as it was too. So either way.
Okay. Sounds great. I'll keep it.
Whatever you want. You have an editorial license.
Has built and sold over 50 companies. 50. Excellent. I just want to set the stage for where this conversation is starting off. So basically, you're a hardware startup. You've gone through the strategic decision to insource versus outsource. It could be that you insourced or outsourced parts of your build, parts of your subsystem, or it's an entire turnkey situation. You are likely looking into working with contract manufacturers, external partners. So this episode is really for you to determine what that entire strategy is. And if you're interested in that kind of earlier stage part where it's insourcing versus outsourcing and the strategic initiative and how to go about that, I will be releasing a separate package for that. So be on the lookout if you are there. So let's start from the absolute basics and the kind of early stage when you first start talking to contract manufacturers. Peter, what are fundamental requirements to think about when selecting a CM?
Okay, so first thing off is know yourself. Enough times, people don't take the time to say, okay, what's our product risk? And it depends on what you're sourcing, because if you're sourcing, oftentimes you can break it into three categories. The first is you're sourcing just a spec-driven product, a nut, a bolt, a plate, and that's an animal on its own. We won't get into that in extreme. My only comment on that is be sure that if you buy it, is actually within the spec. The second thing is built to print, and built to print is really common. And in that case, there's some great plate systems like Partsimony and Fictive. They can help you with that sort of thing, or as many different vendors that can do that. Majority of what I'm going to talk, where I'd like to talk about today, sir, it's your call, is when you're working with someone on a custom part. That's probably the thing that will make the most mistakes on. So know what type of thing you're doing, because there's much greater risk as you move from spec product to a product that you're co-developing with your contract manager. So know that first. Know your internal gaps versus what you're hoping to get from the outside. What you must keep internally, because sometimes you're working with someone on the outside that starts absorbing those things because they're better at them than you, but you really still want to keep them internally. You want to be conscious of that. So know yourself first and your culture. What kind of people do you work best with? Then know your CM. You can find out a lot about a CM online, get their website. Are they an engineering kind of driven company? Are they strictly manufacturing? Do they tend to build the print? Get to know that. Look at if they name their quality assurance. Do they just name their equipment? Which frankly, in my opinion, is the least of your concerns. So take a look at that. Visit them. That's another key thing. And before you start, there's the internet. Yes, I'm old enough, you can see my white hair, that there was no internet when I started and you didn't know a system. It's so great to go to the internet and look up some manufacturing processes before you start looking for your suppliers. Because if you start the discussion with, I'm not sure if I'm supposed to injection mold or vacuum form or 3D print, that's what your discussion is about. And instead of talking to them about what they can do for you and their capabilities. At the same time, you're going to source knowledge before you source services or price. So that all starts. In addition to that, where are you at? Or where do you think you're? Are you at an alpha? Are you at a beta? And oftentimes you'll find out you're not quite where you thought you were. A lot of the accelerators can help you with that sort of thing, but the vendor can too. These CMs can help you do that. The final thing is cultural. You can't ignore cultural. You really want to see who you're talking to, how they're set up, and do they assign an account exec? Are you working with the president? Those are the basic areas. I could go on and on as you say. How's that?
I know that's great. And I think that the nuance of what you astutely mentioned around really do a little bit of homework to be able to make sure that the purpose of your engagement in the early stages is not them teaching you about a process or telling you what fits. That could be something, but that's a different scope, right? That's valuable to do, but that's not you looking for a contract manufacturer. That's you looking for a consultant.
Yeah, you can use your contract manufacturer that way. It's a very old concept of start with the people that you are likely not going to do business with.
Yeah.
And learn from them. Usually they don't mind. If you're polite, you know, you respect their time and so forth. So you do want to find out, but you don't want to wear out your welcome on someone you're really hoping can be your contract manufacturer on teaching you something. You don't want to waste anyone's time, but you particularly don't want to wear out that factor.
Absolutely. And I actually realized that I forgot to mention how I know you, Peter, and this is going to make sense because of one thing you said, and I want to tie it back to that. The reason I know Peter is because I actually attended a ton of his workshops back in the day, and I knew that he put them together. I never will forget the clock we made. I think I still have the Mass MEP clock we made. It was always very inspiring to learn from him. And then very recently, he appeared on my screen when I was joining an accountability board call as a subject matter expert at Scale for Climate Tech. And we got to coach companies together, which was like a beautiful full circle moment for me. And that all that to say is that like readiness level, that piece that Peter mentioned, programs like Scale for Climate Tech help with that. And it's a good thing to, I guess it's always been, I'm curious to know your thought, just a quick tangent. It's always been interesting to see the companies self-assess and then someone else assess them and the discrepancy between the manufacturing readiness levels.
Yeah, it is a great exercise. Doing your MRL, TRL, CRL, customer readiness level, technical readiness level, manufacturing readiness level, using various scales is wonderful. Preferably, by the way, if you use the one that the DOE and the DOD put together, which with scale for contact happens to use, because it gives you the in-betweens. And a lot of times, probably the thing that people don't understand the most is, if you're in the process of something, that doesn't mean that you reached that level. And if you haven't documented it, it means you haven't reached that level. And if you think you're at a very high readiness level for manufacturing, but you have no quality control system yet, you're not at that level, because your manufacturing level can't be up there if your quality control system isn't in place. So it's very dependent. There's 9 threads across an MRL, and it's much more of a system where you want to balance across them than people usually think when they start a company. Because you can, and by the way, you can launch a product that isn't at the MRL of 10. I have launched many products that were way below that, because if the risk isn't high, you can launch earlier before your assured readiness. If it involves safety or high risk of finance, you really need to make sure your readiness level is high.
Totally. So that's product dependent. That makes a ton of sense. And I think what I'm also gathering from what you're saying is, before you even go into this fundamental requirements of a CM, it is good to do almost like a self-assessment and a little bit of soul searching of just what core competencies you want to build in-house. What are your expectations? And then maybe even ask a few people if those expectations are reasonable, because there's really no silver bullet out there. There's some amazing people, but they can't be the answer to everything. So I guess you touched on this. I want to drill in a little bit deeper with it, which is the point about IP and how you engage and how you can protect your IP. And then we can go into the details of that later.
It's so for me, IP, you know, you want to protect your IP. Mm-hmm. At the same time, the safest product in the world is one that you hide in your basement and never bring it out. So you have to release information to people. Question is, who do you release it to? When do you release it? How do you release the information to people? And by the way, that's for design for manufacturing. It happens at the beginning and when you're developing your product, but it also happens 2 years down the road when you're doing a design for manufacturing or value engineering of your product. You also have IP challenges and support. So when it comes to contract manufacturer, because that's our main focus here on IP, you want to be very clear. What is your IP? You also want contractor agreement with them that basically states you maintain the IP. These suggestions, improvements, enhancements to that product that they suggest continues to be your IP. Now, if you're patenting, you may have to include them on the patents. They make a truly material change. That's the strength of the patent. So you also have to have something in there that if you they do make a contribution that changes the patent, they give you the rights to that without any additional cost. Mm-hmm. It's typical. They shouldn't be surprised by it. You shouldn't be hesitant in doing that. So you want to maintain that. But here's a surprise for you. You want to talk IP, but I'm going to also talk NOAA. Mm-hmm. So you really want to, and Sarah, is it time for me to get in a little depth on this, or what are you going to?
Go for it.
Okay, so IP, relative to know-how, people think, wow, if I have my IP and I have my patent, I'm all set. A tremendous amount of the asset of your product is, can it be made? And can it be made often happens or is made possible by the contract. On their side, it may be made with some secret sauce they have, some methodology they have that no one else has discovered. They do not want to give that to you. You have to be careful because you want the best process possible, even if it's their secret sauce, but you got to be careful because you don't want to be so dependent on it and not know how it's done. So you need to build into your discussions, and we'll get into contracts in a minute, the fact that you maintain IP, they know what the IP is, you maintain improvements on it, and you keep knowledge of as much of the know-how as possible and do it honestly with them. Have exit rights from the very start of your approach with the contract manager. Think to yourself, I'm hoping, and you can say this to them, because if you right size, you're going to go with a contractor that probably isn't going to be able to scale with you to your highest level of your expectations. So at some point, you're probably going to move on, or they may get bought out. They may change business. They may do something different. So you want to start and always have exit rights. How do they hand off the files? How do you get a clear definition of what you own? If any way possible, how to take that know-how with you. Mm-hmm. And I'll get into a little bit of that. And if I don't remember to do it, sir, remind me during the contract part of this discussion, you can actually build it into your contract to maintain some of that note.
That's so valuable, I think, specifically because it is one of the most treasured and important parts. It's like the trade secret of these startups, and it's your like moat, quote unquote.
Here's a dilemma. If you have investors, I guarantee you they will get very nervous if you have a single source supplier. Okay, they will tell you how you should have multiple suppliers in absolutely everything. Personally, I don't know how that's possible. When you're a startup and you're trying to do something for the first time, you can't be trying to do it for the first time with three contract manufacturers. You're going to focus on one. You're going to have all your rights established with them so that if it does go well, you can get a secondary supplier. That's the goal. If you really take off, you want that backup supplier. But it's very difficult. I don't know how. Maybe someone else can tell you how, but I don't know how to deal with multiple suppliers on truly innovative product as they help you define how to make it, how to build it, how to assemble it with you if they're that kind of contract manufacturers. They're just making a part, then of course you can have set suppliers. But it's very difficult. And so it's important to all these things we just mentioned a minute ago are really important because at some point you're going to need a secondary supplier, particularly, well, anybody, but your investors will really drive you to it a little earlier than you'll probably drive yourself to it.
I think you're right in specifically that being, it's almost like someone Googled what are the highest risks of a hardware startup, and it came up that a single source supplier will cause massive delays and could be a single point of failure. And it's at the top of the book. And so people tend to pull it out of their back pocket.
There are a lot of things that can go wrong with a single source supplier.
So, absolutely.
That is true. And that's what we're trying to talk about here is some of the ways to make sure that you have the right person.
Exactly.
Over time.
Exactly. I think that instead of the advice given to have multiple parallel lanes with different suppliers, I think the advice should just be you need to be very strategic and mindful of who you choose you work with, and then maybe have multiple suppliers for components. There's nothing wrong with that. But with this kind of stuff, I agree with you.
And you maintain things, we'll get into it in a minute, but then IP, you need to lock down the ownership of the CAD. You need to lock down the schematics. I had a company that we made harnesses. Harness was part of the product. We had a harness maker make it. I got to tell you something. Harnesses are not easy when they're really complex harnesses. It was for trucking. You have to be really careful because they are going to know so much more than you when they give you that harness. And if you don't get those drawings, because there's special software for harness making, we didn't have it as a startup. We put the harness together through engineering know-how. They put it together with a special software. We had in our agreement that they would give us those diagrams relative to that software and educate us on what the software was so that when it was time to go someplace else, we weren't stranded. Single source danger can be really avoided if you maintain the CAD, you maintain the schematics, the test protocols, all the tooling. You don't lose tooling. Yeah, I guess I'll mention that one right now, but ahead, I'll probably mention it three more times today. There was, especially overseas, there was even more so than today, but there still is a tendency for a supplier to grab you with the idea that, gee, you don't have to pay for tooling. Your tooling would normally be $10,000 or $70,000. It can be very expensive. You don't have to pay because we'll build it into the unit price. Problem with that is you better know that tooling can be used someplace else. You better have the rights to ownership of that tool. You have to buy that tool and buy it out at a time. You may want to buy it out to move. But if they say it's built into the units and they're not going to break even until you do 25,000 or 50,000 or 100,000 units, guess what? If you find a product error, they're going to drag their feet like crazy and they won't want to make a new piece of tooling. If you don't like working with them, they're going to make you start all over again with the tooling with somebody else. If you don't really have a clear understanding of who owns that tooling, how you can gain ownership if you don't own it, that it can be converted, that it can be shipped. I've actually heard people say the factory said, come get it. Okay. Box it up and everything else. Anyway, we'll keep moving.
Wow. That's a pretty hard learned lesson, it seems. It's important to determine ownership more than anything. And I don't think it would be the first thing people think of when approaching these types of conversations. I actually want to ask you very specifically, co-development is something you actually mentioned when you were first answering. It's a sneaky one. And I really want to talk to you about that because I feel like specifically startups, they oftentimes work on innovative solutions, and something that they're working on could be kind of quasi also the supplier's subject matter expertise, and they do want to leverage that. But then you get into this kind of, but oh, we're slightly competitive now. So how, right. So co-development, I'll just leave it at that. Go.
Yeah, it just makes me smile, because not many people make a big assumption. I am not an engineer. I have patents. I've mostly spent my life engineering things. I am a finance major by education and a marketing graduate, MBA. So I rely heavily on co-development. In my product development company that I ran, relied heavily on specific laboratories or people that did things, because we would do a chemical product one month and next month we were doing electrical products. So we didn't have all those internal people. So it was, by nature, it was co-development or service-oriented groups. There's nothing wrong with that. Again, let's start out with know what you need for internal strengths long-term and make sure that you're growing them, and don't cause yourself a nightmare because you realize long-term, we're going to need this internal power, and we never worked towards it until we got so big it became very difficult. Once you get past that, it comes down to clearly knowing what you're buying from them and knowing their boundaries. You're filling internal gaps. And let me just tell you right from the start, I probably should have brought this up at the very beginning. I personally have a philosophy that the customer is not always right. You aren't really a customer if you treat your contract manufacturer on these design-oriented products the way I feel you should treat them. They are the department you can't afford to have internally. But that's how you treat them.
Nice.
When you go on a call to a customer, you come back, I call my key suppliers from the parking lot and say, you're not going to believe how well this went. Or, oh, we ran into a problem. Can you think about it? And they will start thinking about it. They'll think about it off the clock. It is just like an internal department. But just like an internal department, you have to manage where their responsibility, accountability lies and where it stops, because you're going to pay them. So you want to know, you can't give engineering without boundaries, for example. They'll go wild on that. I always joke when I have a room full of engineers, which happens often in some of my lectures, and I'll say, why engineers engineer? Because they can. It's why they climbed the mountain, because it was there. That's an engineer. So you got to be careful with that. CMs, if you're not careful, they'll standardize, and they'll standardize to their shop's capabilities if you're not really clear about it. So you may have something and you'll see that they're using screws to put it together. And if you did your research, you may find out, hey, we never want the consumer to get into this anyway. We may want to sonically weld that together, and it would be half the cost. And you ask them why, and they say, oh, we don't have a sonic welder. You want to make sure that they're building, or at least making it. I tend to use the analogy of don't paint yourself into a corner. So even many times when you start out, you have to be willing to start out with something that's not as tightly specced as you wish it could be, but you're starting out and so forth, where they're screwing it together because that's the easiest way to assemble it at the time. But you want to design it so that you know what all where you want to be in, so you don't have to totally redesign something. Best example is 3D printing. Don't 3D print something that later on is going to need a parting line because it's going to be injection molded. Don't make it so that they can't have a parting line. You know, you don't want to 3D, you can 3D print anything. You can 3D, so it never has a parting line, never has a connector, never has anything. It can be one solid piece. You want to make sure when you design that it can go further so that you're not totally redesigning, you're just putting a parting line in and sure the flow, the plastic flow works for injection molding. Make sure of that with your CM. The tooling is optimized, that it's portable, that you can move it out of their facility, that they're not putting it on a one-off press that's theirs for the last 50 years. No one else owns one. Cultural mismatches are a big one with co-development. You want to make sure that you work with them well and so forth.
And how about the IP? Is there a weird kind of negotiation that needs to go into place?
It's no different than what I mentioned earlier.
Okay.
You have to get them to sign in advance the idea that they're doing a service, you own everything. Improvements, enhancements, modifications, and that you will own them and that they will transfer the rights to you. Because again, people will say to me, why'd you want to include them on the patent? Then your patent isn't as valid as it could be. If they materially change something, they're probably, you got to look at the and talk to your patent attorney, but they may end up being on it. But you want to make sure they'll sign those rights over to you for free.
I think that would actually be possible if there was a situation where their business was also producing stuff that's similar. Like I can think of equipment.
Then they wouldn't have a patent anyway. So that wouldn't be IP, your IP anyway. So if you're using something that's there, again, that gets back into that that's know-how, or it's using someone's IP. And if you're using someone's specific enzyme, when I work in clean energy and once in a while, I guess with a reactor or something, if they have an enzyme, and but it's a unique enzyme, only one company in the world makes it. Guess what? If your product depends on that, you better make sure that company stays healthy, that they're always willing to sell it to you, that they're not going to gouge you in price. So that's the single source supplier issue we talked about. But from a co-development standpoint on IP, reasonably good contract. And I will tell you, I shouldn't jinx myself. I have licensing agreements with over 22 companies. I have never been sued, and I've never sued anybody. Contracts are for clarity, not for gotcha. If you make a contract and you say, I hope they don't read this carefully, then your contract is no good. No good for you neither, even if that's in your advantage. If you make it really clear, most problems happen. And I can't tell you, it doesn't just go for co-development. It goes for the startups who have partners and haven't made it clear on what the partnership really means and how much work one founder is going to do versus not. Contracts are a good thing. They're just for clarity. You shouldn't feel insulted. You shouldn't have an issue with it. And here's the last thing, particularly if you're working with a large co-developer. The person who signs the contract is probably not going to be the person who enforces it or works with you.
True.
So the contract has to be very clear, and anyone reads it wet, because especially if you license, I still get a royalty on stuff that I did in 1993. There's no one in that company who even knows who I am. So you have to make sure your agreement is
reasonable, clear, understandable. Totally. That's super interesting. I'm going to ask you one more question that I just thought of, which is exclusivity. Could you, how enforceable, in your opinion, is exclusivity in those kinds of situations where you tell a company, I want you to make this flavor of this, and I don't want you to sell to anyone else? Is that reasonable?
You have to be reasonable. The question has to be, would they have done it anyway? Are they already doing it? Is it their business? Do you want to restrict them from publicizing and trying to sell it, or not making it if someone else comes to them? And sometimes it's to your tremendous advantage to have them do it. For example, one of the companies that I helped find a supplier, find a roll-to-roll supplier for hydrogen membranes, and it wasn't being done on roll-to-roll. And I helped them find this vendor, and I said to them in advance, part of the reason this company is going to be willing to do this is you're putting them into the hydrogen membrane business. Is that okay? Mm-hmm. Are you going to be okay when they try to find other people who want this done? And you know what? It works to their advantage, because it made the company want to invest more money in new equipment. It makes the company want to understand the market better and everything else. It was going to happen anyway. It wasn't something that their company was the only one that was ever going to find this thing. Mm-hmm. So,
interesting.
Well, way of saying to you, it's very dependent on how close it is to that company's already existing business. You can't expect someone to not do something that's their business unless you make it worth their while not to do it anymore. If I said to you, hey, listen, I never want you to do a podcast again. I only want you to videotape me. I'd be
okay with that, Peter.
I'd be willing to offset your regular intentions, goals, not just financial, your whole strategic goal and everything else. So that would be the catch. What you can do is you can say, I would like this exclusive up to this amount. I would like this exclusive for this particular time period. Stay exclusive as long as I can keep the volume over this certain amount. And some of those things may require you to do something more. For example, I've gotten somebody to use a material that they don't normally use. And I didn't want them to use that with anyone else. The material was a unique factor. And I said, here's what I'll do. I will always buy the raw materials if you'll store them enough for you to buy at a reasonable lot size. Because their comment was, If we buy that much, they try to sell it because we can't afford to have raw material we can't use.
That's fair.
I said, I'll buy it. I'll buy out that lot. And oh, by the way, if I stop making my product, I will pay to destroy it or sell it.
Super fair.
Again, imagine them as your department. What would you want your department to have the capability of doing?
That is super reasonable. Do you think it's reasonable to, beyond timeline, call out specific companies being like, they don't sell to these people, I don't care, or like industries?
Anything's reasonable.
Okay. Anything's reasonable if you're reasonable.
Yeah, it's funny. It really drives me a little crazy when someone says, what are best practices or standard practices? And I say, great, that can be everyone else. I want to learn the best practice. Then I want to see if I can do it better than the best practice or differently than the best. This is what you and I talked about. There's continuous improvement and then there's not continuous improvement. I always laugh at that because you want continuous improvement, but real changes happen when someone does it differently. So
I agree.
You want to be able to do both with your supplier. And when you encourage them to do something really different, I at one time convinced a vacuum former to extend the bed on their vacuum former by extra feet so we could do a new material that had a higher melt point, and they did it. And I actually helped them find three other types of products that they could make on it because otherwise it wouldn't have been worth them slowing down the machine cycle time.
That makes a ton of sense. And then at that point, it's almost like you've done their business development.
Yeah. And you made their investment in equipment worth it.
That's awesome. I think that's a good, you're so right. Like specifically with these types of things, it's structures, best practices, standard contracts. Like those were all created by people and it's just limited by the imagination really.
And you want to take advantage of them because they're usually there for a purpose and they're usually very good, but you analyze the risk reward. And when you can find an additional reward for a risk you're willing to accept, then, you know, deviate.
Totally. That's awesome. So actually, since we've been talking around the contract part of things, so I really want to dive into that because I think that the negotiation around the contract, what to expect, how you can get creative with it, these are things that people worry about all the time, specifically those who've never seen it before. So when going into this, what are some things to, I guess I worded it originally as watch out in contract terms, but it doesn't have to be necessarily like, oh, watch out for this, but just we could talk about it in general.
First of all, I'm blown away that I'm involved with the AI applications. And anyone who doesn't run their contract through simple ChatGPT and say, what are the risks? And what am I promising? What are they promising? Highlight the key obligations is crazy. So first of all, it's so easy to review to get a skim on the contract. In addition to your own read, you don't just leave everything to AI, but that's one thing. But there's some basic things that you ought to always remember. First of all, engineering scope, because a lot of the startups and a lot of what we're talking about is you're doing engineering and then you're doing production. Engineering, production. Don't merge them in your head, okay? It's don't merge tooling price with unit price. You want the best unit price possible outside of tooling and so forth. So you want engineering scope to be separate from production scope when you're working with contract manufacturers, especially in joint development. You want pricing to be based on doing, especially engineering. So you want to be pricing to be based, if you can, on the phase, on the deliverable, not on promises, not on schedules, if there's all possible. The critical clauses in your contract, tooling ownership is a big one. Relocation methodology of the tooling is a big one. I did a lot of plastics, so I'm a little biased. I always think of tooling because it's just such a big number. The engineering change authority. You want to have the engineering change authority only to you. If they change something, you want to know what it is. You want that most recent drawing. You want to control the rendition of it. The version control must be yours. You want to make sure that there's true pricing step downs as you go, not just promises, but there's actual targets to your pricing step downs. When I achieve this, the price goes down to that. One that people don't think of often at all. I want to know the yield and the scrap and the rework. Because if I know the yield and the scrap and the rework, either I need to redesign the product to not have as much scrap. Because oftentimes it's my problem and I've done something and I say, why is that? Why are you throwing away so much material? And they said, because you designed it sideways. It doesn't sit on a sheet. It doesn't go two up. It goes 1.5 up. oh, I can turn that around or whatever. So you want to know that. And if they can't do it, if it's because of their capability, you want to be able to switch vendors if they can't get this, if they're just causing scrap because they're not effective at it. Same thing with rework. Forecast liabilities, you want to make sure that you don't get penalized in a big way if you forecast one thing and something else came in. Although dull sandbag, period. End of story. Don't tell someone it's going to be 1,000 units. You know it's going to be 25. Put the wrong production process in, to do everything. You don't want your department down the hallway making up numbers. Don't do it to your supplier. Exit and transition, and then data. Data, test results, documentation of in general has to be in the contract that you own it, that you get it on some kind of regular basis and how it's turned over. Think about the big items that you have to convert if you went someplace else. Just sit down and say, okay, if tomorrow I had to change bids, if tomorrow might, here's an easy one because it's not costing. My supplier gets bought tomorrow. The owner says, we don't deal with startups. We only deal with large volumes. What will you need to know to start someone else up? You should have a transition capability of saying, oh, okay, we already have the newest version control. We have all the CAD. We have all the material lists. We have all the quality assurance proposals. By the way, this is where doing a true MRL to yourself really helps because all this is already documented. If you do a real MRL review.
Oh,
if you do a manufacturing readiness level analysis, a true manufacturing readiness analysis, you're going to find out, gee, I can't get to 5 without documenting all this stuff. And if I can't document it because it's in my supplier's hands, I'm going to have a problem. I'm going to have a problem when I exit. So just think about those things that you would say, oh my gosh, I can't believe I don't know the material. I can't believe I don't know the temperature to send something through. I don't know, whatever it happens to be, you want to do that. And I'll tell you, people will, and this is the problem with sourcing far away from where you live, something that is uniquely important to your company. You need to go and see the process on a regular basis. You want to be able to know that if you have to start up again, it's not totally alien to you. You had it documented. Having something documented is different than seeing it. Very few vendors, if it's truly secret sauce, will let you take a picture. And many times their contract with you will say you can't. And many times their contract will say you can't take our secret sauce. But within the legal bounds you can do, and you'd have to look it up, you want to be able to visibly say, okay, I at least know this, even if I have to find out a slightly different way to do it to not violate their conditions, at least I know that it went through this process. And that, so that's the transition all comes down to, if I had to do it tomorrow, do I know everything I need to do it? Or do I know at least what it is so I can find someone to do it?
Absolutely. I think that when you're entering into those supplier relationships, that's the last thing you're thinking about is how you're going to get out. So I think it is really important, especially in this contract phase. I have an edge case situation that I saw where a competitor bought the supplier.
Yes.
And so that's a little tricky. Do you have any thoughts on that?
First, I'll give you a slightly different one before I forget it, because this is more positive.
Okay.
I've had agreements where I knew the person wasn't going to be competitive long-term, but I knew that they had a really unique know-how. And I said, I ever price it with somebody to, I think if your price ever gets above 15% of what I need it to be, then, and I find someone who has capabilities, you promise that you will help me transition to them under the condition that you get X percent for the next 3 years of every purchase I make. So basically I'm saying you're doing this for me now and you're making 12% or whatever it is. A lot of large manufacturers only make that on that type of business. Like, our, anyway, and I'm going to move it over to here. And by the way, I'm going to give you 3% for the next 3 years. You can help me move it over, or I have to move it over without you. Move it over without you, you don't get the 3% for the next 3 years. So if you're trying to hold me to hold me in by just not helping me out. And by the way, you have to then be nice to them anyway, because they have every right to not help.
True.
A little competitor. Relative to your scenario of the competitor buying it out, I would be looking so fast for how I get out of there. And if you wanted to, you see, I've never had that happen, but I've had people sell a bunch of times. And in my agreements, I say, if you ever sell, here's the thing, here's what will happen.
I like that.
So, yeah. So you may be able to do that in the same way. If you ever get, if a competitor ever buys you, I don't know how often it happens, but what the heck? You could always throw it in there. Someone will probably sign it anyway. Competitor buys you, you will not release how this is done and you will help me provide it to somebody. You can try anything.
Yeah,
that's the
right.
Beauty of contracts is you can propose any. You can say no. You can say no. Do it in a nice way that makes logic for both sides and you usually win.
Yeah, no, you're right. And I don't think it happens. You're right that I don't think it happens often. I think it happens when the market is super niche and you have one of those situations where there's just like four players in the game and everyone has their eye on each other in a way. And one just happens to be a very strategic business developer and decides to buy the supplier. And then all hell breaks loose because you didn't have that clause. And you're like, now all of my data is in their hands.
No, I could definitely imagine it happening, particularly with material, because some or graphene, for example, there's other things, the enzymes, like I said, and somebody becomes a big user and buys them out. Yeah, it's hard.
Yeah,
I had someone go out of business 3 days before they were supposed to ship.
Really?
And the goods were on the floor. Yeah.
Oh, no, what'd you do?
Longer story.
Long story, but you need to tell us what happened.
The bottom line is I didn't get them. I had to find a replacement really quickly. Now, the good news was, everyone out there can laugh at this, is my product was a dispenser for dog treats, and the product that the vendor left on the floor was the dog treats. It was a dog treat company. And so I had to go. I actually found someone else to make these dog treats that didn't make dog treats, by the way, and they made the dog treats to go with my product. So it was like I went back to them first and said, it wasn't one of my business, my customer. I said, gee, can I do the product without the treats? Like, no, I had to find a supplier.
Nice.
But it was on the floor. I actually, when they didn't deliver, I actually went to the facility and the lights were on. It's like,
oh my God.
You're kidding me. It wasn't a small company. It was, I get there. It's a 50,000 square foot building that the lights are all on.
You should have just released dogs from like the pound.
I know. I was like, the problem is when someone goes out of business, they can't even ship what's in the door because it's all going to be resolved through bankruptcy courts.
Wow.
You're out of luck. Anyway, moving on to something more positive.
Yes. No, absolutely. It's funny that you say that because we're going into our midway segment, which is hardware horror stories.
Oh, great.
Which is far from positive.
Bye.
Hi, listeners. I hope that you're enjoying the episode. I just wanted to come back on here to remind you that this episode is sponsored by Onshape and Jigga. Onshape is the only cloud-native product development platform, and now you can apply to be a part of their Onshape Startup Program that essentially gives eligible hardware startups a free year of Onshape Professional. And you can apply now at onshape.pro/thebuildercircle. You can also find this link in the show notes. And now I'd like to introduce our second sponsor, Jigga. Most hardware teams choose between two bad options. Instant quote platforms that trade away supplier relationships for speed, good for one-offs, not great for building a real supply chain. Or local shops that offer trust but hit capacity walls and go silent on quotes. Jigga combines the best of both. Direct access to vetted manufacturers, reliable capacity from R&D to production. You speak directly to the machinists, explain exactly what's needed, and ensure it's done right the first time. And when you come back to the same manufacturers, they already know your specifications and technical needs. They maintain that knowledge so you consistently get reliable quality without having to start over every time. Learn more at jigga.io.
There's one of the horror shows. I had no backup for something that I thought was a no-brainer extra element. Literally, I didn't know where else to get them. Anyway, the common ones are a lot of the stuff we talked about already with as far as you don't control your tool. That's a big one. If you don't control your tooling and you make a tooling and you want to make a tooling change and they say, no, I don't want to make that until you finish the 25,000 pieces and make me break even, there's a problem. So that's a really common one. Another really common thing is you go with a supplier and they're charging you for a lot of things. You don't realize it because you didn't ask enough questions about it. They're charging you for a lot of things you don't use. So value-added services are really important. I think we're going to get into them sometime today, but value-added services are really important. But if somebody has it built into the base price, it is part of their company's financial modeling. Or they charge you no matter what, whether you use their shipping department or not, or they charge you for storage, whether you use the storage up or not. those value-added services that you're not paying for. The importance of packaging. I've had this happen. I've helped some startups that have had this happen. You get your product so perfect and you forget that, gee, can I, because one startup in the clean energy field and their product weighed too much by 5 pounds to be shipped one way versus another.
Oh,
and,
God.
And you end up having to ship it on a pallet and you didn't think it was going to ship on a pallet. Or had another company that put it inside a box that broke apart when it was shipped in a certain way, when it was shipped as individuals, and then the product gets damaged. I personally have had product that the packaging got damaged on the way, or I didn't pay enough attention. I'm guilty of this. You didn't pay attention enough to their requirement for how they wanted it put on a pallet, and it didn't have corner brackets on the pallet, and they charge you for failure to comply. And they charge you a lot. Some companies can charge you tens of thousands of dollars for failure to comply. So remember, packaging matters and how it gets there, both and how it takes care of your product and how whether they accept it and so forth. Assigned a risk factor. Oh, this is the horror story of all horror stories that I've seen happen multiple times. When everyone does their bill of materials, it's almost incredibly common practice to reorganize them by price and reorganize them by lead time.
Yeah.
So that if you're running into something, you want to make sure you don't run out of lead time to get product in time. You want to make sure that if you're looking for cost reduction, you know what costs you the most money. I add a column and I tell everyone else to add a column called the risk column.
Yeah.
How risky is it if this particular part doesn't get done appropriately? I'll give you an example. It's a company that makes pumps for the oil industry. And this thing goes down. I say pump, but it was a part to pumping all the way. And it goes down into the well. And in that is a $27 gasket. And they switched makers.
Oh.
And it's only $27. When that fails, they have to stop the pump, haul up the parts, change it out. That is the most costly part in that entire product.
It's like operations cost. Like,
but for them, it was $27. Oh, well, okay, we'll just buy that from whoever comes up with it. Was within spec. They tend to be a spec oriented product, and what the heck? You have to spend more care. So if you got a risk factor in there that's really high, that's really important. The other is hardware horror story is what's going to fail first. Something's going to fail on your product first, and you should know that for when you're making the hardware, when you're buying the hardware, and so forth. Because whatever's going to fail first, you better be able to get to it.
Yeah.
I had one company that built their entire thing, and the part that's going to fail first was on the back, no issue. They put a panel there to get it. The product in real life always went up against a wall.
Oh, no.
Didn't in their lab. So there's some horror stories there. But it's fun over a beer to talk about the horror stories like those types of things. But more horror stories are much less dynamic and much more oriented to, I had a volume spike and my CM couldn't handle the volume. And I didn't know what I was going to do next. I wasn't prepared for if there was a volume spike. I didn't make clear on my IP. I'm trapped because of time, cash, or knowledge.
Right.
I didn't follow time, cash, knowledge. No prioritization, that sort of thing. So I don't know whether that helps at all. Relationship is one we haven't talked enough about. Relationship misalignment. Your focus is you're an engineering-driven company and your supplier is a sales-driven company. And right. You try to talk to them. And I always say, what language is someone talking in? I look up, even when I'm doing a workshop, I look up every single person going to the workshop. What did they get their degree in? What was their first job in?
Yeah.
Because you tend to find that's the language they talk in. If they're a marketing person, I haven't done marketing really in years and I still am a marketing person. It's my first language. So that conflict is huge. It runs into giant problems with your hardware, because you're sitting there talking about performance and they're sitting there talking about spec or something like that.
Right. Yeah. It's talking past each other in a way. The priorities are not aligned. Yeah. Oh, it's funny because I feel like you've been talking about these horror stories that lead to it's not best practices, really, just these are things you need to be thinking about. And I really appreciate
it. It's okay to say best practice.
No, I'm not. I'm never going to say it. I know you don't like it. I'm not going to say it, Peter.
No, I like it. I like best practices. I guess we should say best practices aren't only practices.
I feel like best practices should not be, it's not just a to-do list. It's not just a right. Wikipedia page. It's right. more about thought and creativity and just learning. Yeah. I don't know. It's less structured, I think, than...
So a lot of these things, you can go through everything we've talked about today and really draw out examples of horrors when people just don't do them. It really comes down to, it's funny, everything in a manufactured product comes down to, you could say people three times, then you've got process, machinery, material, management. Really, do you have your process set? Do you have the right equipment and know where it's going as you scale? Do you have the right material? Do you know where that's going as you scale? And then do you have, are you working with the right people that are doing it? And are you dealing with the right management who are managing it? So, you know, you can look through each one of those categories and come up with, how do I avoid, or put on a positive spin, how do I become as efficient as possible in each of those areas?
Absolutely. And I think that I want to transition to the next bit, which is when you're picking your CM, there's a lot of them. And there's the big guys, the Jables of the world, and then there's kind of mom and pop shops. How does a company go about right-sizing their CM? Are there any kind of metrics that they should look into, in your opinion?
Yeah, there are. And first of all, don't pick your CM for where you're going to be in the future. Okay. You pick them for what you need them for today, and you make sure that doing that doesn't paint you into a corner to change as you scale. But if you try to get a one side, if you're either the smallest customer someone has or the largest customer rate someone has, it's not a good thing. Okay. So a lot of startups say, I want to get the biggest company possible because then I can scale with them and so forth. You can't get their attention.
Yeah.
Or they're too small and they can't tell you what's going to happen when you scale. They can't help you transition when you scale. So first of all, you want to get the right size company. Then for me, I jump right to culture. I want to get the right cultural company. Do they assign me, is it the owner? Do they assign account execs? Is that account exec an engineer, or is it a marketing, or is it a sales guy who's just going to sell to me? Shouldn't have said it that way. You can tell I don't culturally work with the sales oriented account exec. So I like engineering account execs on products. They should match that. Value added is huge. It just gets you so much when you're a startup. And value added are the things either they don't charge for or they don't necessarily talk about in their sales effort. Maybe you don't want to offer it to everyone in the world. I have had people store my product for me. I've used other people's shipping departments. I don't want to create a shipping department when I don't have enough to ship. And right. I've used my last vendor, the vendor who's the last one to touch it. I've said, hey, can we store it here and your people ship it when I get an order? And oh yeah, we can do that. Well, let's work it out. We're going to charge me by order. You're going to charge me any storage and so forth. And by the way, they're people like it. It's different. It's exciting to be part of a startup for a company that's a supplier to get exposure to those value added things. The other things are things like picking them because they know certifications and you don't know.
Right.
They know assembly processes that you don't know, and they allow you to document and help you work out the assembly process. So there's a lot of those value added things that aren't just part. Again, remember, there's three different types. If you're doing spec driven, you don't care about any stuff. In fact, you hope the person has no overhead, which they could magically hold the stuff and ship it to you. And then you got the build to print, and then you got what we're mostly talking about is, and even the build to print overlaps with the custom stuff. But those people can have tremendous value add. They can be your mentor. They can help you decide on materials. They can help you with how's this going to scale. And a lot of that, you have to give back. That there's the thing that startups often don't realize is their power, the power of what they can contribute back. I did a huge piece of research a while ago, but I don't think it's dramatically changed. And we met with and talked with and surveyed 87 manufacturers and 125 startups. And the manufacturers surprisingly said volume was the third or fourth reason, revenue was the third or fourth reason that they looked for working with a startup.
What was the first?
Number one reason was to get to know a new market.
Yes, I agree with that completely.
Understanding it to the market. Number two was to excite my younger employees.
Interesting.
To let them try new methods, processes, to have them working on something that's a little bit more exciting. And again, it is a little biased because we went to a lot that wanted to work with startups, which means they usually had engineering teams on hand and so forth. Realized the power of that. And in return, they have these other things that they're willing to do, that they have expertise in, that they can teach you and coach you and help you with until you grow. Those are the value adds are important. Making sure that you aren't buying services you don't need, which I mentioned earlier, that's not built into the pricing, that they are helping you understand what the product could be eventually so that you do know that it could be sonically welded, even though you're screwing it right now. All of those things, if they have that larger perspective, I like when it's once in a while you'll run into a contract manufacturer that worked at a large company and then decided to start their own business. The founder, he or she are knowledgeable about a larger picture than their one facility that they worked in. Anyway, did that?
Yes.
Enough?
I think one particular very specific question I will ask is, do you have like a rule of thumb of what percentage of their like annual revenue you should take up? I know that's not the initial driver, but just for people to have a notion of, oh, okay, I make up 5% is one I've been using and have heard of. Do you have a rule of thumb for that? Or do you feel like it's really not?
I personally don't. You may, at the start, for example, you may go to a single shingle engineer that's just really good at engineering, and you may be 100% of his volume for 6 months because he's doing project-oriented work. So, you know, where you go to a design firm that only has three people in it and you're a large percentage for a very short period of time. Now, if you said to me, I'm working with a company and on an extended basis,
yeah,
more than 20% of their business, I would start to worry.
I see.
Because at that point, it starts to become, gee, what happens if I usually probably, what's more important to me is if they're willing to tell you, if you feel you're that big a percentage, I want to know how many other people make up the other 80%.
Yeah.
If they told me, listen, you make up 20% of my business, you're a really important customer. And then I said, how many people make up the next 80%? And they said, oh, five. I'd be very concerned because if one of those drop out, their business is going to change. They can't afford. Usually if someone's business drops by more than 20%, they can't keep the same staff or level of business.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's a good way to think about it. One thing that, again, I just thought of that I think is one of the, I guess it's a debated topic, let's say, of related to when is a good time to talk to a contract manufacturer in your product development lifecycle, in your opinion?
If you're familiar with a contract manufacturer, talk to them when it's a pencil drawing, because it may change what you're doing. I don't think there's a time too early. I think you have to be careful that it's a supplier that wants to talk to you at that early stage, and that you are not wasting their time, that you have specific questions. There's suppliers I still call once a week to say, how you doing? Here's what I got going. What do you have going? That's the other thing about if you get someone into a new category or industry, if you become their mentor in a category, you become friends. I still keep friends with my suppliers that I haven't done any work with in 20 years. I still talk to them on occasion. Again, this is a little different the older you get. I've had their kids go to school in Boston and they come to my house for a holiday because they can't get home to their parents. To me, business is exceptionally fun and very personal. So it's I'm biased.
A little different. I'm just thinking about like a startup that has zero connections and started.
They should get to know what they really want to know. And again, use the power of the internet to know what you think. And then, by the way, realize that you could be prompting AI wrong or whatever, and you want to confirm it with someone. It's fine, especially if you go through someone. If you say, listen, I am just looking for information and I will only take 20 minutes of your time. And then only 20 minutes of their time. I don't know a vendor that won't give you 20 minutes at some point.
It's the scope of the conversation that you need to be aware of. to enter into that conversation and be open with them.
You better know what they do for a business. You better know what that person you're going to talk to, what their education was, where they worked before, what they're interested in. It is one of those things where you want to engage immediately on as deep a level as possible so that they don't feel you're wasting your time. You're getting true answers. This is, like I said, the last thing you want to do is call someone up and say, now, can you talk to me about the different plastic production processes?
Yeah.
I've had many people call me and ask me questions like that. And I've gotten a little harsher over time where now it's like, hey, listen, prop chat.
Google it.
Come on. This is a little much. And then call me back when you think you're trying to figure out which one to do yourself and why.
Yeah. Okay. I'll ask one more question related to timeline. How long, and you're going to probably say it's relationship dependent and product dependent, but I'm still curious, is how long can people continue conversations before putting pen to paper? Because some startups tend to essentially be risk averse when it comes to suppliers. So they keep talking, they keep getting ideas. They're like, we're going to sign the contract. Just one more call. What are your thoughts on that?
Ask them what they would expect from a customer. Their customer. Mm. How many calls do they want their customer to make to them?
Fair.
It's a wear out factor. And by the way, if you don't have those other things, like I said, if you're not introducing them to a new market, if you're not exciting their internal people, if you're not respecting their time, all you are is potential revenue. And I start out most of my workshops with something I've been repeatedly told I maybe shouldn't say so strongly. If you're a startup, you are incredibly likely to be a crappy customer. Okay, low volume, stop the presses. You need the most valuable people in the building's time. You know, how to manipulate. And by the way, that's something that I should have started out with on what you need to know. You need to know how your manufacturer makes money. Most manufacturers make money on efficient machine time. So if you're not letting them run a machine and getting paid for it, they are losing money for you. So if you're using their engineering group, most don't make money on their engineering group. If they're lucky, they break even on them. You're using engineering. You're not manufacturing. They're losing money. If you're talking to their president or GM, and you're not producing product, you're losing money for them. So if you want to know how long you can talk before your vendor's going to get tired of you, think about how much money you're losing. Assume that they're losing $200 an hour on you when you're not helping them run a machine.
That is an excellent way to think about it. On the flip side of things, I feel like there are people that, just as I said, feel like, hey, like I'm a customer, like I could take up as much time as I want. There is that kind of part of the spectrum. But then there's also the, they will not talk to me. Like I'm a startup. They won't. I have no leverage. Why would I even bother? Is there like any, I guess, like words of encouragement that you would want to give those folks?
The person who says, why would they talk to me, has not done a good job creating a story. A CM is no different than an investor. If you can't get a CM to listen to you, then you can forget about ever getting investor money. Okay, because a CM is investing in you when they start, because they probably aren't going to make revenue. I shouldn't call you a crappy customer, because you could be a good customer eventually. But I should have said, you're not a revenue-producing customer at the start, because you can't make them more than $200 an hour on what you're having them produce. So if you tell them a good story, and that story includes what they're going to get out of it, what they're going to learn, how you're going to excite their employees. And in many instances, and a couple of the people I've worked with, because I do clean energy stuff a lot of times, a couple of them are clean energy enthusiasts. So they like giving back. So for them, just working on a clean energy product makes it worth them taking the time with someone that they never make a dime off of. They never get an order from. I tease the younger entrepreneurs about, hey, find out if the owner or the GM has kids your age, because I'll tell you, they have a much greater tolerance. I know that sounds silly, but it's like you're trying to give back. You know, whether you consciously say it or not, you're thinking in your head, my kid had to go through this. I had to go through this. Let me do this person a favor. Most people in business, particularly business of their own, have had a tremendous number of people that went out of their way to do them a favor. And they will always want to pay it back if it's a good story. So if you don't have a good story for your investor, probably don't have a good story for them. If you have one, there'll be someone who's willing to talk to you. If you respect their time and have good questions and limit each meeting to an agenda that you give them in advance, you'll be all set.
I love that. I love that so much. And on that line too, I want to ask, we like talked about contracts. Now we're talking about CMs, like it, basically being on your team, right? Like we were talking about this. They are like an external, they're an internal department you can't afford that happens to be external, and thinking about what they can bring. When structuring these like agreements or just engagements, how are there creative ways that you can incentivize them to improve your product? Like I'm thinking if they are charging you per time spent on a product that they're building for you, you can look at it and say they're not quite incentivized to speed it up because they make more money if like more time is being spent on it. Is there a way to structure it so that they are willing to cut down the assembly times? They are willing to find creative manufacturing techniques to make it cheaper. How do you do savings, cost share, or other types of things?
In most instances, you can do a design for manufacturing process with them. Okay. Mm. Invite them to a design for manufacturing process. And in that, you are going to show them that by being, helping you be, you can, by the way, be more efficient and have a better product and they don't lose any margin because again, if they're using less scrap that they have to eat, if they're using less downtime they have to do, if they're doing less rework, a lot of things they do for you, they don't make money at. Mm-hmm. The more efficient you're running, usually the more efficient they're running. And by the way, design for manufacturing process, if you do it right, everyone gets very involved. They want to show their value, just like anyone else who goes to a group engineering meeting. And you assign them, if they're willing, you assign them a role in that meeting and say, this is the case. You could, if you want to, and I actually did this with a company, was we did a program, a lean manufacturing exercise, where we said, every margin point you find, we have you keep half of it.
Yeah.
So, well, we're going to help you find margin, so you're going to be better off, but we get half of it back.
Yeah. So it's a win-win.
Yeah, you could do that. But I got to tell you, most people who are running a business, think about it. They get their people to run your part more efficiently. Theoretically, they should be running their company more effectively, which makes them more competitive and they get more business from other people.
They can spend that time on a different customer's project, et cetera.
And they can apply that learning to someone else's projects when they quote it, more competitively quoted.
Certainly.
This episode is brought to you by Scale for Climate Tech, empowering climate tech companies to scale from prototype to production. Building a climate tech hardware startup? Ready to move your prototype to scalable manufacturing? Scale for Climate Tech is accepting applications for Cohort. This free 6-month program connects you with hands-on manufacturing training, direct supply chain access, and one-on-one support from over 40 industry experts. And I happen to be one of them. They've supported 102 climate tech companies on scaling their journey. Learn more and apply at forclimatetech.org. Scale for Climate Tech is supported by NYSERDA and administered by Second Muse in partnership with NextCore.
Maybe I'll ask one more question that could be a total can of worms. Again, I'm thinking of it on the spot for some of them, which is in regards to, you said don't choose a CM that is for your future self. Choose one that is in line with what you're trying to build now. There's a lot of CMs that have this opportunity where you start in the US, for example, in the early stages, and then they move you to higher capacity subsidiaries in other places. Yeah. What are your thoughts on that?
CM selection is strategic, not strictly sourcing. Okay. So if you strategically, you have to pick the right product. So if your product's not going to change, I guess realize this, when you produce out of your control, out of your sight, especially overseas, you're not going to see the evolution of possible improvements. You're not going to see band-aids that they put in place. You're not going to see what I always call it, a good CM. They have what I call big CMs, I should say, not good ones, big ones. You'll see what I call floor engineers. And that's an engineer that's going around and saying, oh my gosh, if we put a fixture there, that would be done more efficiently. Or, oh, that assembler is having trouble doing that because the clip is too small, or the wiring, it needs an extra inch. They're doing that. If it's someplace else, they may even be changing your product without you knowing it to make those improvements. And now you have a product that's changed and you don't know it. Or you're not getting the advantage of the experience that makes you want to make a change. But if it's an established part and you're done and you're using it for a limited time period moving forward, or you're going to be using it for an extended time period, absolutely confident it's not changing, sure. Yeah, competitive pressures, pricing pressures is always there. If you have exceptionally good paperwork and spec, I'll just kill one misunderstanding people have. Crap is not produced in China. Crap is produced, or Mexico, or anyplace else. Crap is produced with bad instructions and bad specs. If you go to an efficient ISO factory anywhere that I've ever been, you will get, where you run into trouble is when someone goes to another country and says, can you save us 30%? And I've actually had clients of mine, after I licensed the product to them, tell me they want to reduce the product. I go to China and the Chinese factory says, if I make that wall thickness, that thickness, it will not pass a drop test every time. I've had clients actually say, I don't care. Then they say, oh, crap was produced in China. No, it wasn't produced in China. The spec was produced here, delivered there. And it's, you did that here, the same thing would happen. So if you're not careful with your spec, no matter where you get it produced, if you're not good with your quality control documentation, no matter where you get it produced, once it's out of your sight, that is your control. And you're not going to get the learning curve, no matter where. So if you're living in Massachusetts and you're getting the thing produced on the West Coast, it's no different than getting it produced in Mexico or China.
Totally.
I prefer to get stuff made here because of all sorts of other issues. And frankly, well, I like things made in the U.S., but I don't think it's an issue because of quality.
Yeah, it's poor storytelling, poor specking, poor requirements, standard operating procedures, whatever you have it, your documentation.
Or poor selection because there are crappy suppliers everywhere.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. That was all so valuable. I already know so many people, even from personal connections that I have in startups, that would just get such a kick out of this episode. I am so grateful for the time that you've given me, Peter. And also, this is just a glimpse into your brain. It's just, all of the people that have had the joy of working with you, we're all incredibly lucky in the hardware community to have you. I greatly appreciate how much time you've spent with me and giving me advice on how to run workshops. I was able to come to you and you told me how to go about it. And I went about it the way that you told me, going to the audience, understanding who I'm talking to, and really made all the difference. So I cannot thank you enough for all the work that you do, the knowledge you share, and collaboration that you show to this community.
I appreciate it. I will tell you, it's very selfish. I learn something every time and with another person, I learned something. It's interesting. So thank you for giving me this chance. And if I can ever help, let me know.
Absolutely. Do you have any kind of closing advice for the listeners or any personal projects that you want to share?
I'll give a teaser that I will be releasing app in the not so distant future that will curate you from concept to commercialization and a investor deck. Reach you through the process, and that's the next big process for me in this whole thing. Doesn't antiquate anyone, doesn't mean you can stop thinking. In fact, it helps people more. The better your input in, the better your result out. But that's the big one. And my leaving note on this topic of contract manufacturers is, again, source knowledge first and then service or product, and know that your culture matches their culture.
Absolutely. I was going to say, we're losing Peter to SaaS. Oh, no. After years in hardware. No, not you too. No, it's received, and super excited to see all the stuff that you work on next, and can't wait to continue collaborating and learning from you and all of the above. So thank you for your time once again.
Thank you. Take care.
The opinions and information shared on this podcast are for informational purposes only. We always recommend that you seek professional advice before taking any action related to your business or personal ventures.